Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau. In the midst of today's widespread interest in our founding fathers and other national heroes, our guest this week, Michael Farquhar, offers us another angle on our nation's long list of great men. They are tantalizing true tales of historic misbehavior, as he puts it. Farquhar, the author of the national bestseller Great American Scandals, will be with us in just a few minutes. Historian Stephen Mim will be joining us as well, offering us some historical insight into the age-old pastime of counterfeiting. And Alex Berza returns to offer us yet another of his ever-popular hoaxes in history. But first, let's take a look at some history in the news, all reporting new discoveries of things past. First, archaeologists have unearthed 13 lecture halls thought to be the first traces of ancient Egypt's University of Alexandria. If so, it would be the oldest university ever found, dating to the 5th century. Another team of archaeologists have made an important discovery at a site in Guatemala among the ruins of the ancient Mayan city of Sival. Sival was one of the largest cities in the Grand Mayan civilization of Middle America, housing as many as 10,000 people. The city flourished from about 500 BC to AD 100, at which point it was abandoned under mysterious circumstances, never to be occupied again. Previous excavations have uncovered ceremonial pyramids and a large complex surrounding a central plaza. But the most important of the latest discoveries are two identical, well-preserved, 9-by-15-foot stucco masks of a Maya deity with one eye and snake-like fangs. All of these findings are forcing historians to re-examine their earlier belief that the Maya were a simple agrarian society. And finally, closer to home, yet another team of archaeologists have unearthed a cooking hearth in the Sierra Nevada mountains that they believe belonged to the ill-fated Donner Party, which was trapped by snow in the winter of 1846-47 en route to California. Almost half of the party of more than 80 immigrants perished. Survivors, they later reported, avoided starvation only by eating the corpses of their fallen companions. Researchers have found bone fragments at the newly discovered site that may be large enough to provide enough DNA to verify that story. Next up, a look back at some of the biggest scandals in American history, a history of counterfeiting, and the story of the Winstead Wild Man. This is Talking History. There's no lack of interest in our founding fathers and other prominent historical figures, and most of what we encounter and what we read about these individuals is complimentary, even patriotic. But our guest this week, Michael Farquhar, offers us a different perspective on them. In A Treasury of Great American Scandals, published by Penguin Books, he looks at our history of embarrassing, ineffectual, or just plain bad presidents and other political leaders, and shows why the failings we discover in our elected officials today are nothing new, that it's all been done before. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Brian. Glad to be here.
Okay, let's clarify two points before we start. The subtitle of your book is Tantalizing True Tales of Historic Misbehavior by the Founding Fathers and Others Who Let Freedom Swing. Now, it seems to me, from the title and from what I've read, you're trying to be satirical here, not mean-spirited. Is that the case?
Oh, that's absolutely the case. I want this just to reflect my love of history. And I think these stories are just so colorful, which so much history is, and that's what I feel is the shame that's not taught in schools, is this colorful side of history. There's so much emphasis on dates and pedantic teaching that I think a lot of this color is missed, and that's unfortunate.
Well, I agree with that, although I can imagine some of these children coming back into their homes with some of these stories and telling them to their parents. They would get quite a reaction, I'm sure.
Well, this is definitely not a book for the elementary school level, that's for sure.
Right. Okay, second point for clarification is you're really not dealing with what we would consider to be the worst episodes in American history. You don't treat Native Americans and slavery, for example. Instead, you're dealing with, and again, with humor, individuals who have just behaved badly.
That's right. I think that those other topics are worthy of more serious treatment. And while they're serious topics in this book, I think individuals lend themselves to anecdotal stories much better than those episodes do. So those are for another book.
Okay. Well, we'll wait for that book, too. There's a number of issues, more than we can ever deal with here, but let's just start with a few here that I thought were pretty interesting. First of all, you deal with generational rifts between fathers and sons, and one example I found interesting to start with was Benjamin Franklin. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, you know, I think people don't ever hear the story about Benjamin Franklin and his son William, who was the royal governor of New Jersey. And when the revolution started, Benjamin Franklin had his son imprisoned. And it was a horrible imprisonment, meaning he lost his teeth, his hair, his wife. And George Washington felt so bad for him, he pleaded for him to be able to visit with his wife before she died. And Franklin said no. And it's just one of those stories that got lost, but it's a fabulous story. As a matter of fact, it was William Franklin who was running around that cow pasture with the key and the kite and the electricity while Ben sat in the safety of a shepherd's shed.
Were they ever reconciled?
No. Yeah. They were not. He died estranged. Ben Franklin died estranged from his son.
As another example of strained relations between fathers and sons, you take on John Quincy Adams and his sons.
This is what he said about himself. I'm a man of reserved, cold, austere, and forbidding manners, and I have not the pliability to reform it. And that certainly was the case. His son George was so afraid to face him that he dove off a boat into Long Island Sound and drowned himself. I mean, it's a very sad story.
It certainly is. What about his other sons?
Well, the other sons did fairly well, although Adams treated them all as if they were total failures. Just a very cold man.
Mm-hmm. You write that George Washington's mother's tomb reads, Mary, the mother of Washington, and then you joke that it probably should have been Mary, bother of Washington. What are you talking about there?
Poor George. I mean, I say in the book that she was more aggravating to him than his false teeth. She just seemed to have a penchant for publicly humiliating him, and she went before the Virginia House of Burgesses and cried poverty, saying that George wasn't supporting her. I mean, he had to make a mortifying rebuttal that he was indeed taking care of her. She wanted to keep his purse at her disposal and did everything that she could to embarrass him, and it was awful for him.
Well, that's not an uncommon story. If we pick up the next one, which is Mary Todd Lincoln and her son, Robert, that's kind of a sad one as well.
It is sad because Mary Todd Lincoln's kind of gone down in history as a bit of a loon, and really it's her son who's responsible for that. He had her committed into an insane asylum because she was eccentric, certainly. She had seen a lot of tragedies in her life and may have been a little bit imbalanced, but certainly not insane. But she spent like a crazy lady, and that's what drove Robert to really ambush her. And she was dragged to this hearing and was decided that she was insane, and she was put in an asylum for a year. And that's kind of the version of Mary Todd Lincoln that's come down to us, that she was crazy. And it's just certainly not true.
And did they ever reconcile?
No, absolutely not.
So there aren't many happy endings here.
Not in some of these. In others, there are. There's some reconciliations. But these are all having to do with the unhappy family relationships among great Americans. And unfortunately, a lot of times, there were no reconciliations because the behavior was so bad.
Okay. Well, this next one, at least, is a little bit lighter. I think many of us have heard, but perhaps not all of us, the famous quote of President Warren Harding's father, who said to him one day, Warren, it's a good thing you weren't born a girl because you'd be in a family way all the time. You can't say no. Tell us a little bit about that one.
Well, I call Warren Harding the people-pleaser president, and that's what he was. He was a hell of a nice guy. He was just completely incompetent. He's probably the worst president we ever had. One of his big problems was he really couldn't say no to all his cronies who were given positions of power in the government. Maybe your listeners are familiar with the Teapot Dome scandal and some other scandals of the Harding administration. Those were all his cronies who were behind his back just robbing and plundering. And really, Harding's legacy was destroyed largely due to them. He couldn't rein them in. He was basically too nice of a guy.
Yeah, too nice of a guy to be president. That's interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
We could dispense with the mother-in-law jokes, but there's some reality in history here, a grain of truth, and maybe you could tell us a bit about Eleanor Roosevelt and her mother-in-law.
Well, I call her the smother-in-law. Sarah Roosevelt, she was truly a nightmare. This was a woman who wanted to control every aspect of Franklin and Eleanor's life and the life of their children. She really went out of her way to turn her grandchildren against their mother. I was the one who raised you, not Eleanor. For a wedding present, she gave them a house in Hyde Park. The problem was she built her own house right next door with four levels, each level attached, where she could just come and go as she pleased. Eleanor was overwhelmed by the woman, and Sarah never really liked Eleanor. Franklin was her baby, and she wanted to keep Franklin, and it was just another unhappy relationship.
And yet Eleanor became one of the great ladies of all time. That's interesting.
Absolutely. Sarah has kind of been obscured in history.
Right. Well, it wasn't just mother-in-law. Sometimes it was brothers, and you write about Ulysses Grant and his brother and Jimmy Carter and his brother. Tell us about those relationships.
Well, that's the last section in that section on bad family relationships, and these are the embarrassing brothers. Billy Carter, I call the mother of all embarrassing brothers. He was, again, bent on humiliating Jimmy with his hosting the Libyan delegation and taking a big fat fee for that. Orville Grant was another of the embarrassing brothers. He was taking kickbacks for the sale of trading post franchises on the Western frontier. RB regulations required soldiers to use these trading posts, so they were paying a fortune for their basic necessities, and all that money was going to Orville Grant. Interestingly enough, it was General Custer who was one of the people who had to testify against him.
Well, so much for family relations. Let's move on to a slightly different topic. What about those national leaders who were involved in, well, let's say duels at this point, even causing the death of their opponents? We have a couple of them that I thought were interesting, Aaron Burr and Andrew Jackson. Tell us about each one.
Well, it's interesting because I think people tend to think of the Aaron Burr-Alexander Hamilton duel as the duel in American history. And the fact of the matter is it was just one of many. This is the way gentlemen used to settle disputes in the old days. Any point of honor that was under dispute, gentlemen would challenge each other to a duel. And, of course, we know in that duel between Hamilton and Burr, it was the Vice President of the United States fatally killing one of the Founding Fathers. And again, it was just one of many. Andrew Jackson, the future president, was involved in so many duels that they can't keep track of them all. He died with a number of lead bullets inside of him. He was an angry man, and any point of honor that he felt had been compromised, he would challenge. But this was congressmen and senators and future presidents, governors, generals, all different sorts of people were engaging in these duels.
But they brought charges against Aaron Burr. I'm not, to the best of my knowledge, they didn't in Jackson's case, but they did in Burr's case.
They did indeed, and he was a fugitive. And in this book, there's also a second chapter to his life, and that was the accusation that he had committed treason in trying to separate the western part of the United States and set up his own empire as Emperor Aaron I. He's a pillar of what I call the American Hall of Shame, which is a whole section in the book about the nine most notorious Americans.
Only nine?
Well, this is the inaugural bunch.
Okay.
They'll be added as they deserve.
All right. One of the great myths of American history is the idea that politics just continues to get dirtier and dirtier every year, not realizing that dirty politics got a pretty early start. And some of our listeners may be a little surprised that you single out in particular the election of 1800. Tell us why that was a dirty campaign.
Well, you're right. People kind of bemoan how ugly campaigns have gotten. Right now, they are placid, peaceful ordeals. Compared to what went before, that campaign of 1800 between Adams and Jefferson was just nasty. Adams was accused of trying to reunite the United States with Britain, that he was an aristocrat, and that was his only interest. There was actually the rumor that he wanted to marry some of his children off to some of George III's children and start an American dynasty. Which, you know, at a time when the United States was just in its infancy, that was a hideous allegation. By the same token, Jefferson was attacked as a fanatic revolutionary. The Connecticut Current said this about a murder, robbery, rape, adultery, and incest will be openly proclaimed. The air will be rent with the cries of the distressed. The soil will be soaked with blood and the nation black with crimes. You wouldn't read that kind of stuff now.
Nope, that's pretty telling. I guess we should explain that although there were two previous elections, both of those elections were really involved, actually three. We're talking about elections where Washington was the candidate, so no one was going to challenge him. But even when we get to the election of 1800, neither of the candidates are actively engaging in this dirty politics.
No, at least not out front.
Right.
Adams and Jefferson, as you probably know, did turn out to be enemies. That's a story of reconciliation, but that's a whole different story. Those two did actually reconcile and, as you probably know, died on the same day, on July 4th. But the newspapers then were very partisan, and that quote I read to you was from one of those partisan newspapers, and it just got vicious.
Okay, well, let's walk up the mall a bit and talk about the foibles of senators and congressmen, and in particular, this might be a surprise to some people, outright violence on the floors of these sort of august houses of government. We don't have a lot of time, but tell us about the Charles Sumner event.
Well, Charles Sumner was a senator from Massachusetts, a staunch anti-slavery, and he gave his famous Bleeding Kansas speech, which he attacked Andrew Pickens Butler of South Carolina and his mistress slavery, as he called him. Butler's nephew was a representative, Preston S. Brooks, didn't appreciate that speech at all. And a little while later, as Sumner was working at his desk, Brooks came up behind him and slammed him with his cane over and over and over again and beat the holy hell out of him. I mean, Sumner was out of the Senate for 3 years and barely lived after that attack. But that was just one of many attacks in the Capitol. It was unbelievable. The first one was in 1798 when Matthew Lyon of Vermont spit in the face of Roger Griswold because he disagreed with him. Griswold got back at him when he hit him upside the head with a hickory cane. But again, this is an example of how we kind of decry how ugly it's gotten today. But you just have to look back at history and see that it really is a calm period now.
Right. Well, we've got all kinds of examples we're not going to get to in your book, and our readers can get caught up with it, but we need to at least get him one sexcapade. Can you give us this one example of such an episode in our history?
One of my favorites is the Representative Breckinridge of Kentucky, who took it upon himself to lecture young women across the country about the virtues of chastity. It was a lesson apparently lost on his teenage mistress, and he was run out of office. But that kind of power and sex just go hand in hand, and there's just great stories about misbehaving congressmen in the book.
Okay, give us one more. We got 2 minutes. Give us another one.
Well, another interesting was right in Lafayette Park, which is right in front of the White House, congressman from New York, Daniel Sickles, shot and killed Francis Scott Key's son, who was having an affair with Sickles' wife, in broad daylight, in front of the White House, after he heard that they were cheating. And he actually got off on a temporary insanity defense, the first time that defense was ever used, and it was successful in his case.
All right. That's a good one. That's the one we have to end on, unfortunately. But it's all the time we have for scandals. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Brian, I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
Great. Good to have you. You've been listening to Michael Farquhar, the author of A Treasury of Great American Scandal, Tantalizing True Tales of Historic Misbehavior by the Founding Fathers and Others Who Let Freedom Swing, published by Penguin Books. And this is Talking History. The U.S. Treasury Department is in the process of changing much of its currency in an attempt to make it less susceptible to counterfeiting. But if history is any guide, suggests our guest commentator, Stephen Mim, it has an uphill fight ahead of it. Counterfeiters have a knack for circumventing almost any obstacle put in their way. Mim is a professor of history at the University of Georgia and is working on a book about counterfeiting in the 19th century.
Don't look now, but the country's money is changing, really changing. After decades of consistency, the greenback has begun a startling metamorphosis in its appearance, with the introduction of enormous presidential heads and splashes of color. The threat of counterfeiting is the impetus for the change. But if history is any guide, the Treasury Department has an uphill fight ahead of it. Counterfeiters have a knack of circumventing almost any obstacle put in their way. It has been called the Golden Age of Counterfeiting by one historian. Between the Revolution and the Civil War, counterfeiters operated with impunity throughout the United States. The reason? Individual banks, and not the federal government, issued the nation's paper money, with each such institution printing notes of their own design. Counterfeiters thrived in the confusion created by having thousands of different notes in circulation. Counterfeiters in the early 19th century exploited new engraving, printing, and photographic technologies to ply their trade. Counterfeiters today rely on a similar wave of cheap and easy-to-use computer hardware and software. The recent additions of the greenback are an attempt to mitigate this threat, but there is nothing particularly new about special inks, paper, complicated watermarks, and complex designs. Counterfeiters have always managed to circumvent these obstacles. It does not bode well for the Treasury Department, yet one thing our government has going for it is that it need only protect a limited number of designs. Indeed, the strength of today's money supply lies not with its diversity, but with its simplicity. That's a legacy of the Civil War, when the federal government began to wrest control of the paper currency away from private banks, issuing the forerunner to today's greenback. That reform meant the nation-state had a vested interest in protecting the currency, and a new national policing agency was established to prosecute counterfeiters to the fullest extent of the law. Indeed, before the Secret Service began protecting the president, its members spent most of their time protecting the money supply from fraud, imposture, and insult. By the early 20th century, the Secret Service had largely succeeded in eradicating counterfeiting, and an era of almost unquestioned confidence in the greenback began. Today, there is a hope that a splash of color, some watermarks, and a new look will continue to frustrate the counterfeiting community. Perhaps it will, but as the bankers of the early republic could attest, it is one thing to make money more difficult to copy. It is altogether another matter to make it impossible to imitate.
You've been listening to Stephen Mim, professor of history at the University of Georgia. An earlier, much longer version of Mim's commentary appeared in the July 2004 issue of Commonplace, an online journal. When we return, Alex Berza tells us about another of his hoaxes in history. This is Talking History. As promised, we conclude this week's program with another historical hoax from the files of Alex Berza. Berza is the author of The Museum of Hoaxes, a collection of pranks, stunts, deceptions, and other wonderful stories contrived for the public from the Middle Ages to the new millennium. This week, Berza reports on the Winstead Wild Man.
In August 1895, New York City papers received a wire story about a naked, hairy man that was terrorizing townspeople in Winstead, Connecticut. Intrigued, the paper sent some reporters up to Winstead to find out what was happening. Actually, not much was happening up in Winstead. But when a pack of big city reporters showed up wanting to know where the naked wild man was, tongues of the local residents quickly began to loosen. Soon reports of the wild man began to pour in from all over, and with each new sighting he grew progressively fiercer. He gained at least a foot or so in size every day, and in some accounts he sprouted tusks. Then he became a massive gorilla with thick arms that hung all the way down to the ground. All these terrifying reports fanned a state of near hysteria in Winstead. People became afraid to leave their homes for fear of encountering the monster. A posse of over 100 armed men was organized and sent out to hunt down and kill the creature, and after days of searching, the men finally succeeded in shooting something that was seen lurking in the undergrowth, but the fearsome beast turned out to be nothing more than a local farmer's stray jackass. Eventually the truth came out. There never had been a wild man. The original wire report had sprung from the overly fertile imagination of Lou Stone, a young reporter for the Winstead Evening Citizen. From there, mass psychology had done the rest. Over the succeeding years, Stone became famous for the hundreds of stories he wrote about the strange flora and fauna surrounding Winstead, including his description of a tree that grew baked apples, a dog that talked, and a chicken that lay red, white, and blue eggs on the 4th of July. He was referred to affectionately as the Winstead Liar. After his death, the residents of Winstead named a bridge after him. The bridge spans Sucker Creek.
You've been listening to Alex Berza, author of The Museum of Hoaxes and the curator of the virtual museum of the same name, available to you at www.museumofhoaxes.com. That's it for another week of Talking History. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Fiona Beatty, producer. Alex Smith, our studio engineer. The opinions offered by our guests on Talking History, however, do not necessarily reflect those of the program staff or of the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Talking History or the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. And as always, we invite you to send us your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to talkinghistory@umkc.edu or send them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, 64110. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeVeau.